This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Today is Giving Tuesday. It was started 7 years ago by the 92nd Street Y, a cultural centre in New York, with help from the United Nations Foundation. It's a way to focus on charitable giving after the commercialism of Black Friday and Cyber Monday as the holiday shopping season gets into full swing. Well, joining us to talk more about charitable giving here in Central Florida is Mark Brewer. He is the CEO of the Central Florida Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matthew.
What does Giving Tuesday mean to you?
Well, Giving Tuesday is actually a part of philanthropy that is meant to try to reestablish a market share strategy. So it's really about retail philanthropy.
So you're kind of taking a business model and applying it to charitable giving.
That's exactly right. So if you think that people have a lot of money to spend around the holidays and they may not actually be paying attention to community or the things that go on in the community, so the ability to have one day a year when people are focused on doing that. Now, I have to tell you that through time, it's changed some things, but it hasn't had as big an impact as I think everybody had hoped it would. Mm-hmm. It'll take more time to create that retail side.
Why do you think that is?
Primarily, most of philanthropy is moving now towards strategic philanthropy. And so you see that even younger philanthropists are more focused on getting to solutions to problems, identifying ways that they can see measurable outcomes. And while Giving Tuesday can draw people to that, the vast majority of the nonprofits that raise money in Giving Tuesday are just trying to find a way to get a share of your wallet on a day when you might be giving and thinking about giving. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, it draws national attention to something that never had national attention before.
When it first came out, were people in the nonprofit field saying, this is it, this is what's going to kind of help us out from now?
Well, I think if you look at the transition over time as federations and United Ways moved away from being the primary campaign money providers, and people began to see that there was no centralized place for everybody to plug in and give, this looked like it might be a solution to that. Now, it's much more retail than even a federation model because you really don't have a lot of connection with the people you're giving money to. You're doing it in an online transaction. Mm-hmm. But all the same, it could be the door that opens for you to see something you didn't know before or to hear a story that you didn't know before. So I think our hopes for it is that over time, you know, last year, year before, $300 million or so in actual philanthropy flowing through that. The downside of it is that most of that money is not new money. It's money that moves from other campaigns or other giving. In other words, you may be already set to give a human services nonprofit a gift this year, mm-hmm. but the ability to do it on a day in which you're going to get recognition for it and maybe even a match, that would be compelling and a good retail reason for you to make that decision that day.
Mm-hmm. The fact that it's easier just to click a button rather than make a phone call, I mean, does that help nonprofits out?
Well, it is for donors. I mean, I think if you think back to the kind of core of democracy, you've got three sectors, public, private, and nonprofit. The nonprofit sector's primary focus is to creatively and innovatively do things the other two sectors won't. And so if most of that is driven by people who contribute, who give, who help, those aren't people that are really much engaged in what's going on. They're just throwing a little money in the circle to help you out. Mm-hmm. They get harder and harder to get to. So on one single day when everyone might be paying attention, you could kind of get the ear and the wallet of some people. That's a good entry point.
Right. Are there certain people who are just giving anyway? Like, is the goal really for nonprofits to try and reach people who wouldn't normally?
Yeah, that's what you would hope. The reality is there's some compelling reasons to give on Giving Tuesday, one of which is the attention that people get, right? There's also the concept that if I give on Giving Tuesday in some markets around the country, there's match money available, so that would mm-hmm. be a compelling reason to do it. And just because you're caught up in the joy. You know, after every disaster, there's this pent-up yearning to do something, and no one knows what to do. Giving money seems like the one thing you can do. Mm-hmm. In times of joy, it's the same but reverse emotion. And so I think to the largest part, if I'm thinking on Friday about getting all the cheap Christmas gifts I can get, and then on Monday I'm going to really be focused on doubling down to get good online deals, mm-hmm. it seems like there'd be some spare change left on Tuesday to give to the greater good.
Thinking about people helping out in the aftermath of disasters, I mean, there are so many things that could take your attention, right? There is the victims of the campfire out in California. There are still hurricane victims rebuilding their lives. There are so many competing demands for people's attention, people's charitable instincts. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate that as a nonprofit?
It's really difficult. There is donor fatigue at this point around disasters. And part of it is not just the disaster itself, but what people think that might mean about our country and the way we are. Mm-hmm. So when you have continual shootings and then even the disasters that, whether or not you believe in climate change, if you keep seeing them, and at every straw it goes back to people giving money to help, there's a point at which you feel like your pocket's not really deep enough and you can only give to a few things. So that's really the beginning of prioritization. People don't tend to stop giving. They just tend to be more prioritized and a little more strategic around the gifts they make.
Mm-hmm. This, though, I mean, this season right now, the kind of end of the year from mid-November on through to Christmas time, this is the most important time for nonprofits, right?
Absolutely. And it's the most important time from a traditional reason that we have to realize may or may not continue. It's the most traditional time because this is the point in time where everybody, whether you're high net worth or low net worth, you're trying to figure out how much money do I have left before the end of the year and what could I give that would benefit me from a tax deduction by December 31st. Mm-hmm. And so it's a compelling reason for people who make a lot of gifts to kind of amp up at the end of the year. And it's a reason for people that haven't given at all this year to make a last gift that might be tax deductible. That, of course, has changed a bit with the tax law. And so, to be honest, nobody's really sure what this year is going to look like or the impact that it might have. Mm-hmm. And there's some indication that middle income folks and lower income folks who are actually higher level percentage of income givers than high net worth folks, there's some indication that those folks may be retarded a bit from giving, but because the exemptions are so high now that there's no reason to itemize. There's no reason to think about that. You're going to get the exemption whether you give or not.
So do you have to wait for a year or two to see how that new tax law shakes out?
Yeah, our data seems to indicate that it'll be 3 to 5 years before we'll know for sure. But the trends for higher net worth people and people who are really concerned about tax deduction go to bundling their gifts and perhaps every other year making a large bundle of gifts to get the tax deduction, and in the off years taking the exemption and not worrying about it. These strategies are just now coming out now for the strategic investors, philanthropists, mm-hmm. and they're working through them to figure out what's the best way to not just get tax advantage, but to make their money go further.
Do you think that sort of crosses through the mindset of most people when they think about charitable giving, or is it
no.
simply just, I want to do something to help, here's what I'm going to do?
We have some interesting data from a study done last year that about 16% of people who are middle-income folks who don't itemize were concerned and vocal about the possibility of losing their tax deduction, when in reality they don't get the tax deduction because they don't itemize. Mm-hmm. And so the reality is most people give from the heart and they're not really thinking about a tax deduction. What the deduction does is it gives you a compelling reason to give more and give sooner, mm-hmm. and that's its real impact.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm talking to Mark Brewer, CEO of the Central Florida Foundation. Mark, I wonder if you could just walk us back for a moment and talk to me about the foundation of the Central Florida Foundation. Why did it come about and when did that happen?
Sure. The Central Florida Foundation is the region's community foundation, and a community foundation is a public foundation established by and for the people of a community who want to create philanthropy. So if you think of it in terms of you and I creating a private foundation or making large gifts from our checkbook, it might be easier for us to create a foundation to do that, but the expense and the difficulty of doing that are too much for many. So a community foundation's role is to establish funds that are foundations and provide the intellectual ability and staffing necessary to help people actually pursue their philanthropic goals. The Central Florida Foundation was established in 1994 when a handful of people put $1 million on the table, and today it facilitates about $120 million in philanthropy every year.
Are you going back to the same donors year in, year out?
No, we have about 400 charitable funds, and the reality is with 1,000 people a week moving into the community, there's a fair influx of new philanthropy, mm-hmm. Which, by the way, for the typical nonprofit who's out fundraising is a real challenge because they don't get to interact with those folks very often. So the difference between giving, donating, and philanthropy is that one is a response to an ask, that's a donor, mm-hmm. where philanthropy is an impact investment made on your strategy. You figure out what you want to give to and what you want to change and how you're going to measure it. Where a donor would say, what you're doing is so important and I trust you, but I have no idea how to measure this. So here's some money and good luck. Keep me posted.
One of the things that the foundation has been involved in is working with the homeless, right? And there is the Homeless Impact Fund. Talk to me a little bit about how that came about and the need, because homelessness has kind of, it's popped up on the national radar. It's been a big part of the conversation here in Central Florida for the last few years.
That's right. And we've had tremendous success here. So the Central Florida Foundation is the philanthropic investment bank for a broad community initiative that involves lots of different nonprofits and the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. And what we've done over the last 3 years is move to a place where we've rebuilt the homeless system, the system that actually houses chronically homeless people. And today the success is immense. We've saved millions of dollars and housed 339 people who will remain housed. Now we're scaling that system over time. The difference between what other communities are facing, take Los Angeles, where you have 55,000 homeless people on the street, and what we're facing is that we actually can solve this problem because it's a smaller problem for us. But, it's growing, but it's a smaller problem.
And to that point, I mean, you mentioned the 1,000 new people coming into the community on a regular basis. I mean, some of them are going to be people with the money and the wherewithal to help out. Some of them are going to need some help.
That's right.
It's a challenge, right?
So, yeah. So if you think of homelessness in three phases, a chronically homeless person has a mental or physical disability and literally has lived on the street. The median here in Central Florida is 7 years. Mm-hmm. They're not coming in from other places or coming here because it's warmer. Family homelessness, on the other hand, are the people who come here, they get an opportunity, somebody loses a job, there's no family member that they can connect with. And so what we see is this kind of increase in homelessness as affordable housing becomes more and more of an issue. That's kind of there are two source problems there. And one of them is if you earn $35,000 a year, which is a median salary in Central Florida, you can't actually afford to rent a studio apartment in downtown Orlando.
And that's not an easy problem to solve.
It's not. And in fact, if you look at a lot of nonprofits creating job opportunities in the $12 to $15 range, that's actually not enough money to work and be housed. Thus, we see a growing number of homeless people who are employed. Mm-hmm. They just can't afford a place to live. So we have to kind of attack these at two levels. One is to fix the housing problem for homeless people, and the other is to try to make affordable housing more affordable for all of us, not just poor people and homeless people.
You seem pretty bullish on getting this problem solved, though.
Absolutely. We've been really focused on it for the last 3 years, and I think this community movement, which includes public, private, and includes all the jurisdictions, that it includes lots of nonprofits and investors from around the community. Because we've seen this great success, it costs $31,000 a year to leave a chronically homeless person on the street. We can house that person and keep them housed for $18,000 a year with all the services necessary to make them safe and secure and to hopefully get them back on track to be productive citizens. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, when you can see that there are ways to fix this both economically and from a human standpoint, you just have to dive in and you have to stay with it until you get it finished.
And is that a problem? Because, I mean, people like to see results, right? They like to say, okay, I'm making a contribution here. And, and it could be like a corporation could say, okay, I'm going to donate a large amount of money, but I want to see some results from
this.
And if it takes longer than a couple of years, they might say, okay, that's it.
Yeah, so what we've done is we've created a scorecard for the community, and that scorecard is very clear on the metrics of what we're doing and how we're doing it, and all of the investors as well as the rest of the community can watch that scorecard. And I think it's the success at that scorecard level where people see it. Now, remember that most people only know about homelessness what they see, and it's usually the guy with the cardboard sign. Mm-hmm. But homeless people look a lot different depending on where they come from.
Right.
And so understanding that homeless people are just like you and I, but something's happened. And in the case of chronically homeless people, they actually have benefits. They just don't collect them because they live on the street. Mm-hmm. So our ability to get people into safe housing and then get them connected with revenue streams that can keep them alive is really the key to this. We don't want to look like some of the Western cities. And those mayors out there will tell you that the reason they look that way is because they didn't pay attention to affordable housing 10 years ago. And once that gets out of hand, sometimes you send people on a track they can't get back from.
Does the Central Florida Foundation do anything in the way of kind of lobbying to try and get some movement on these, or are you purely focused on the philanthropy and sort of helping people channel the money in the way they want to see it channeled?
Yeah, well, that is certainly true, but the reality is this is a public-private pursuit. So over the next 3 years, in order for us to continue to scale the system, it'll take about $24 million in public money and about $6 million in philanthropy, and that seems like not too much money to get done, and the jurisdictions are looking at that now and are on board with it, and we think the private philanthropy will be on board with it as well. Mm-hmm. So it's really about not finding dollars to replace other dollars, but getting the right dollars in place to pay for the right things, if that makes sense.
What are some of the other things that the Foundation is working on, because homelessness isn't the only issue that you're tackling, right?
No, it's not. And we tend to be proactive around trying to identify source problems we can focus on. All of our 400 fund holders have their focuses. The foundation is focused around this homeless impact fund. We're focused around an affordable housing, regional housing trust, which we're launching this month. That'll be a trust whose job it is to acquire real estate and then develop affordable housing on it, leaving the dirt out of the transaction. So if you buy a $350,000 house, if you weren't buying the real estate underneath it, it would be substantially less expensive. If you're renting something for $1,200 a month, if you didn't have to pay for the dirt underneath it, it would be substantially less expensive. Mm-hmm. We'll begin that work in Paramore, where we're really actively acquiring real estate right now, and then we'll spread it out across the jurisdictions. We've also launched a very interesting social enterprise accelerator called Rally, which over the last year and a half has now sent out about 16 companies that are social enterprises. They're either nonprofits or for-profits, but they're profitable either way, and they have strong, readable social measures. The concept being that if you can actually accomplish something on a social measure and make a profit doing it, you're sustainable without donated dollars. So you're never going to convert the entire nonprofit sector to that, and that's not the intent. The intent is to find things for which private sector revenues can actually pay for things that will generate broadly measurable and transparent social outcomes.
Is there an example you can give me? I mean, is like mass transit something?
That would be one of them. A company called Omnimodal, which is one of the first exits from the accelerator with a really emerging business plan that's transitioning a bit now, focused really on figuring out how to get you connected with your public transportation so you're not standing out in the rain waiting for a bus that's supposed to come. Mm-hmm. You have some idea when the bus is actually coming. We've had environmental companies, a couple of entrepreneurs from UCF that were able to license some technology from NASA and use it to remove PCBs from water. Hmm. And they found out a way in a pilot to do this in San Francisco Bay that attracted huge venture capital. So that has not only long-range green and environmental impact, but it also has social impact for the communities that have downsides connected to those PCBs.
Mm-hmm. Are there some things kind of further out in the future where you're trying to think about what the challenges might be in 10 or 15 or 20 years?
Absolutely. We have a project coming out of the oven here later this year in which we're going to try to engage with communities across the region to get people to talk about actual issues they can take control of. As a reporter, I know you've been to some of the community leader gatherings where all the smart people get in a room and they work out on a whiteboard what the strategy is and how to deal with it. But when you take those strategies into communities, you find those aren't actually strategies that connect with people in communities. So the ability to get people together to talk about what issues they see and how they might take control and then bring some philanthropy to that to make investments to help them, we think the data from that and the ability to engage people, that's called social capital, by the way, which is one of the things we're a little negative on in Central Florida, the ability to get people to come together, to work on problems, to vote, to go see their elected officials. This is a project that will get people together in deep discussion and let them take responsibility and advantage of opportunities to go work on things they care about. And then we'll give that data to community leaders to help inform those bigger strategy issues.
Are you saying that people in Central Florida aren't as willing to get engaged in these things as elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, oddly enough, we rank like 49 out of 50 in terms of when you take the key kind of social measures, which are, do you give at least $25 to charity? Do you vote? Hmm. Do you attend community meetings? Do you visit? Do you know who your elected official is? Do you visit them? Would you come together around a table to have a community discussion about a problem? And by the way, it's pretty clear, Matthew, that this is not a moral ineptitude of ours. It's the fact that we're young. 68% of our population is under 44. We're very diverse.
You're talking about Central Florida.
Central Florida.
Because Florida as a whole, I mean, has this
different story.
Image of being a retirement haven, right?
That's exactly right. So our good old boys are disappearing now, and what we have is an onslaught of three younger generations who are here really independently and entrepreneurially to go after their dreams. And so it's not as easy. We don't have as many connected systems in the marketplace for people to get connected. And part of our job at the foundation, we think, is to make that a stronger opportunity over the next several years, because that social capital leads to engagement, which leads to both philanthropy, voting, and hopefully people who take advantage of the power and influence they have in their communities.
Mm-hmm. Mark Brewer is the CEO of the Central Florida Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it, Matthew. Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, Hurricane Michael is still fresh in the minds of Floridians in the Panhandle as they continue rebuilding and recovery from the devastation of that October storm. But some Florida residents are still facing repairs from the 2017 storm season when Hurricane Irma slammed into the Sunshine State. Hear about the efforts still underway to help Floridians affected by Irma. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Some communities in the Florida Panhandle face a long recovery from the devastation of Hurricane Michael, which roared ashore in October. But even as the recovery effort from Michael continues, other Floridians are waiting on repairs from the 2017 storm season and Hurricane Irma. Some of that help for low-income Floridians is available through the State Department of Economic Opportunity. The deadline to register for rebuilding or repairs through the state's Rebuild Florida program is next month. The Department of Economic Opportunity's Deputy Chief of Staff, Erin Gillespie, says her agency is trying to reach those residents who still need help.
Well, our agency, the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, is partnering with the federal government to bring funding down to homeowners, businesses, and communities that still have impact from Hurricane Irma. So the first phase of the program, the Housing Recovery Program, will help rebuild or replace homes that were damaged or destroyed from Hurricane Irma for those low-income communities across the state.
And you have a bunch of buses to try and get some publicity around, you know, the help that's out there. Where exactly are those buses going to be and what are they going to be doing?
Sure. Well, we've done a full marketing campaign to try to encourage people to register who may have needs left over from Hurricane Irma. Registration ends December 23rd, and so people can register on our website at rebuildflorida.gov, or they can go into one of our Rebuild Florida centers across the state. We have several in Central Florida, and as you mentioned, we also have three buses traveling across the state going into communities to help get folks on the bus and registered right away.
And what kind of help can people get? Is it sort of financial help? Is it in the form of a loan? Like, what sort of assistance is out there still?
Well, the Rebuild Florida program actually comes in and helps repair or replace your home. So although the families won't be giving a check directly, what they'll get is a contractor who will come to their home and make repairs and or rebuild the home completely. So we'll actually have someone come in and take care of all the repairs that are needed for a home, and the families won't have to cover the cost of that.
What sort of uptake has there been of the program so far? I mean, clearly you're still kind of looking for some folks who might be outstanding and still need some assistance. Can you give me a sense of how many people are aware of this program and have signed up for it?
We have several thousand. I don't have a number in front of me, but we have several thousand people who have registered already. But we want to make sure that before the deadline comes, anyone who may be eligible who still has needs from Hurricane Irma is aware of the program and registers for assistance.
And at this late stage, is it typical for this kind of help still to be out there sort of, you know, this long after a hurricane has come through?
It is. This program is actually a partnership with the Department of Housing and Urban Development at the federal level. And this program typically comes in about a year after a storm. So immediately after a storm, there are many resources that come in. People are familiar with FEMA. They come in after a storm and make sure that you have what your basic needs are met, that you have food, clothing, if they can repair your house to a degree that it's livable, they'll do that. This program is specifically for those families who have exhausted every other resource. Their insurance didn't cover it. They didn't have insurance. People who are low income who are renting, but the homeowner may not have the amount of money to fix the house. So this is really for affordable housing and low-income families who just haven't been able to meet their needs after the storm, and it is typical that comes in about a year later.
And is it because you are talking about folks in these situations, is it harder to reach those folks? I mean, are they as likely to be sort of connected online and finding access to some of these resources?
You know, we typically don't have a problem with that, but we make sure that we do as much outreach as we can. So we have a marketing campaign. We have information available on our website. We have billboards out there. We have the buses that are also helping people register, but also have information on the side of the bus about the website. So trying to make sure and get the word out there is a huge part of this program, and we appreciate your help in doing that. As much, you know, media as we can get to pass the word along or put on your website so that people can connect from there is very helpful.
Because we're talking about storm season 2017 and the lingering impacts from that, are you finding that some folks are saying we need help from the most recent storms? Are you having to sort of direct those folks elsewhere?
So our agency, the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, we're on the ground immediately after a disaster. So there's a phase that we call response, which is meeting those immediate needs. Does someone need a loan to reopen their business? Does someone need access to health care or food or some other living arrangement? We work with our partners at the Division of Emergency Management and private sector partners across the state to try to help meet those immediate needs right after a storm hit. So we've been in the panhandle every day since Hurricane Michael hit, and there will be a program similar to this that will come out for Hurricane Michael also. It's passed by Congress, so when Congress passes the program, then we'll have the funding to help those communities as well.
Mm-hmm. I imagine, the images we saw from Hurricane Michael and the stories we heard of the devastation there were pretty stunning. So I imagine there is going to be a lot of work involved in getting those communities back up on their feet once that time comes too, right?
There absolutely is. And like I said, we've been there pretty much every day since Hurricane Michael hit. And you're right. I mean, I've been in every county that was impacted by Hurricane Irma, and there were no counties that saw the devastation that we see. In the Panhandle Marathon and some of the areas in the Keys are the closest, I would say, to seeing that level of devastation. But you have multiple counties where there are huge, populations of homeowners and businesses that you'll see whole neighborhoods where every single house is demolished. And you just didn't see that in Hurricane Irma. So our agency has been working very closely with our local and federal partners to make sure that we're bringing every resource we can to help those across the state. Whether it's Hurricane Irma or Hurricane Michael, we're continuing to work very closely to help all of those Floridians who need assistance still. Mm-hmm.
Erin Gillespie, as far as Hurricane Irma and those impacts, I mean, as you say, the storm was very different. It had sort of a different impact. It did impact pretty much all of the state of Florida, but the kind of scale of the impact was different. In central Florida specifically, can you point to some areas which might have been harder hit than others?
You know, central Florida had a good bit of impact from Hurricane Irma. I think one of the interesting things we've seen is we've had Polk County was one of the counties that had the most initial folks coming in to register, which was a bit of a surprise. And obviously Orange County now, and as you get further south, you'll see more damage, especially along the coast. But there was quite a few central Florida counties that were listed as most impacted, and we've sort of seen that across the state as we've opened up registration and we're asking people to apply for the program. There'll be many people in the central Florida area who will get assistance through Rebuild Florida.
And is this it? Is this basically the kind of last opportunity if people are still finding that they need to do repairs or even rebuild their home? Like once that deadline rolls around, is there going to be any other help out there, or is this pretty much your last opportunity to get that assistance?
Well, we're really encouraging people to register by the deadline of December 23rd. What we'll do is all the people who are registered at that point, we will process them through the system and we'll provide the funding to help repair those homes. And if there's additional funding at the end of that, we may open the registration process back up to additional homeowners. But it is a first-come, first-served program if you meet the eligibility criteria. So we're really encouraging homeowners who have damage and have needs from Hurricane Irma to go to our website at rebuildflorida.gov and register.
And some of the criteria, can you just kind of list exactly what you would need to qualify, or some of the things that you might not qualify if you don't meet those criteria?
Sure. The most important is where you live. You have to be in a county that was impacted by Hurricane Irma. And then this program is specifically for low-income individuals. And so we'll be taking a look at income, where they live, and how much damage they actually sustained from the storm. Just want to remind people to go online to rebuildflorida.gov. You can also see the bus schedules and the locations of our centers there. And you can also call our call center at 844-833-1010.
And have you had some pretty good turnout at those bus locations?
We absolutely have. The buses have been very successful. We move them around very frequently. So there's a schedule online for a week or so out, and then we continue moving it as we see need. So the buses have been a very successful part of the program.
Erin Gillespie with the Department of Economic Opportunity, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Intersection, Burrow Press focuses on the work of Florida writers. The print runs may be small, 1,000 books at a time, but it's a publishing house with a big vision for enhancing the literary scene in Central Florida. A conversation with Ryan Revis of Burrow Press when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Burrow Press is one of the only independent literary presses in Florida. Since 2010, Burrow has cultivated and promoted writers whose work is focused on the Sunshine State. They also sponsor book readings to help promote the work of Florida authors. For a look at what's coming up in 2019 with Burrow Press, we caught up with Ryan Revis. Ryan Revis is the publisher with the Burrow Press. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we spoke to you last about a year ago. Quite a bit's changed since then, of course. What's new with literature here in Central Florida?
I think the profile has raised. We had released, when we spoke last, a collection of essays and poetry by fiction, all three, by Florida writers or writers who grew up here. And just a couple of weeks ago, actually, the New York Times Magazine published a linked Florida fairy tale collection with a lot of the writers that we'd published in that previous anthology. So I don't know. I think maybe it's the Florida theme and Florida writers are only growing in interest and mm-hmm. morbid curiosity.
Florida writers, are they kind of having to go elsewhere to find success, or are they sticking around?
I think like with any other writer, not every writer who grows up here wants to be called a Florida writer, but a lot of the good ones have gone on to move elsewhere. A lot of times writers will move for a creative writing program or to be closer to like the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. So I think it varies. We've got a couple great homegrown writers who are still here in town and a lot who've, you know, gone on to live elsewhere. So mm-hmm. Florida's still in them, though.
Yeah, it's hard to shake, apparently.
Yeah.
You were in Miami a couple of weeks ago for the Miami Book Fair. This is a huge deal in the literary scene, right?
Yeah, it's massive, and we're lucky that it's only a few hours away from here. It's something that we attend every year as like a vendor. So we'll go down there and have our Burrow Press booth and meet all kinds of people. The great thing about Miami Book Fair, unlike a lot of the other academic type conferences, is that it's full of readers. They do bring in about 400 authors, and it's amazing, and there's tons of panels, but you get to meet so many readers, and people come by the booth. HarperCollins is there, Grove Atlantic is there, and, you know, we're lucky enough to be just right in that same row with them, Akashic Books, and Red Hen Press, actually, is another one that I got to know a little better as a booth neighbor this year. So there's all kinds of, you know, publishers of all sizes, writers of all types, but the readers are what's really cool. Like, I've had lots of people come back to the booth. We've been there 3 years in a row now as a vendor, and they're like, oh, I got this book last year. And I'm like, oh, here's what's new. So it's a really special experience for writers and readers.
As a smaller publisher, do you have to go to those things? Like, if you didn't, would you be really missing out on a big slice of new customers?
I think so. I mean, I think it's ideal. Not a lot of publishers of our size have the budget, and we barely do, but we can make it work at Miami because it's so close. Mm-hmm. We're just now starting to talk about being more of a frequent visitor to like the Brooklyn Book Festival, the LA Times Book Festival, the ones that really capture a lot of readers, so we can kind of do more national outreach and have more of a presence nationally.
Is your goal to see some of the writers that you've kind of cultivated here in Central Florida be on some of those panels at the big name book fairs?
Absolutely, yeah. And sometimes they are, which is great. It depends, you know, sometimes on when a book is coming out and who the author is. So just last week or 2 weeks ago at Miami Book Fair, the author of our latest book, Space Heart, Linda Buckmaster, she was on a panel because her book is sort of interest to Florida, and they were able to pair her up with another memoirist. Linda's book's about growing up on the Space Coast with like a rocket engineer father and a congenital heart defect, and she's kind of got a wild story about being one of the first children to undergo successful open heart surgery, and there's Teflon in her heart. The surgeons were improvising, and so when you have a good book, I think that being on the radar of the festivals is good, and we've been able to kind of have an inroad with Miami Book Fair due to our sort of Florida connections, and they've been really kind to us. So mm-hmm. we do get to have those authors on panels every now and then.
I mean, a lot of the authors we've talked to you about in the past have been more in the realm of fiction, but mm-hmm. is nonfiction something kind of new for Burrow Press, or is it something you're looking to cultivate more?
Yeah, we venture into it when the occasion arises. So a lot of our authors we find through folks we've published online. So we publish a new story, poem, or essay every week online. And so every now and then we'll do a call for manuscripts. And if a nonfiction manuscript comes our way from an author we've worked with and it's really good and we have space for it, then we'll take it. So that's mm-hmm. kind of how Space Heart happened. And that's our second book of nonfiction.
So, what was the first one?
The Persistence of Rivers. which was a connection through the Florida Review. It was the winner of the Jeannie Leiby Prize. And so we kind of partnered with them to publish that. So nothing to do with Florida, but kind of connected through Florida institutions. Yeah.
Do you worry at all, Ryan, about getting kind of too narrowly typecast as a publisher of only specifically Florida things? Like, would you, I mean, are there some authors in your stable who are writing about stuff that doesn't have anything to do with Florida? They just happen to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think with our twofold mission, it can be a challenge to kind of straddle the line between local and national. So we do the best we can with our community programs. We're obviously very grounded in Orlando. We do lots of free events here. But at the same time, we're marketing books to the larger nation, and they're available, you know, in bookstores and libraries and whatnot. And so, you know, we just try to kind of craft a message that says this is where we're from. Occasionally, we are wont to publish something about Florida or to publish Florida writers. Mm-hmm. But we're generally a traditional literary press, and you better like us. But that's part of the reason of trying to reach out and do more national festivals and stuff like that, too, is to sort of let people know who we are, because I think the message resonates no matter what. And people are curious about Florida, too. So
do a lot of people find out about you from word of mouth, too, like the authors who've published through Borough Press, or people have heard of an author through Borough Press? They'll say, hey, this is a publishing house which could be a good fit for you as a writer.
Absolutely. I get lots of emails from people who have a friend who's published something that's kind of Florida related, or they're from Florida, and that's how we find work as well. But yeah, the writers we've published who aren't from Florida, like Ben Gwynn, we published him this year. He's from Pittsburgh and wrote a dark comic satire called Clean Time. He, you know, we brought him to Orlando. We brought him into the scene. We did an event with him. The locals got to meet him. But he also did a big launch in Pittsburgh and got a big write-up, like a half-page write-up in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And so through little things like that, through his event and the coverage, people hear about Borough and they reach out and they're like, oh, I heard about you guys. This is really cool. And I find also that cities that are sort of underdog cities, kind of like Pittsburgh, even though it's a very literary city, will often reach out to me and say, oh, it's really cool what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think what Borough does in Orlando resonates with other sort of small cities that are not necessarily bright stars on the literary map nationally. So,
And you're hoping to correct the record in some way there?
I think so. I mean, it sounds nice to say that, mm-hmm. but I don't have a chip on my shoulder or anything. But I do think that it sounds a little bit maybe arrogant, but I hope the work speaks for itself. But I also don't mind, you know, beating the Florida drum either.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Ryan Revis, publisher at Borough Press. You've mentioned some of the events and things that you do here to promote fiction and other writing in Florida. What are some of those things that you've been working on this year that have really taken root?
Yeah, so this year we inherited a reading series called Loose Lips from Todd Cavanis. Todd was a local poet, and he'd done a really long-standing reading series called Speakeasy for a while. He'd changed over to this series called Loose Lips because I think 10 years was enough for Speakeasy. He kind of retired that. And Loose Lips is a series where four or five different writers will read fiction, poetry, essay inspired by the last 30 days of news. And that happens monthly at Lil Indies on the first Tuesday of the month. And so Todd, unfortunately, moved, like sometimes happens in Florida. He didn't move out of Florida, but he moved elsewhere. And so he was kind enough to let us kind of take that series over because I would frequent the series. I had read it at one time, and I thought it was a really cool thing for Orlando to have. So I didn't want it to go away. And so as of June, we started sort of running it. And I knew that it was important to the community, and so I didn't want to change much about it. But I did want to focus on expanding the network in a way. We've done events since 2010, and so we've seen a lot of writers come through, and the community is always expanding, but I kind of get old and slow, and so I want to make sure that we're introducing new writers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concept or the tweak that I made to Loose Lips was that every month we have a new guest host, and the guest host picks who the writers are. So we'll have a local person come in, we'll give them a few months advance, and then they'll kind of curate a nice little lineup of new writers. And a lot of the times it is writers who've never read at a Borough event before. So it works out kind of nicely, and we get to meet new writers and hopefully expand the community.
Have you been around long enough now that you sort of feel like you're part of the establishment, and you have and now you have a responsibility to find those writers and others who and readers who are not part of that establishment, sort of broaden the tent?
Yeah, I think I always had any kind of responsibility scares me, and any the word establishment scares me, but that's just because I think, like, growing up, I was more of a DIY kid, made zines, and, you know, didn't want to be remotely associated with anything establishment. But what's real is that there's lots of writers in Orlando, and they're all, you know, hoping to improve their craft, hoping to get their work published. And I think it's important for them to meet each other, to connect, and to have opportunities to share their work. And so I don't know if it's my responsibility to do it, but I certainly enjoy doing it, and that's a big part of what Borough does locally.
So what else is coming up for Borough and writers who've published with you in the next few months?
Yeah, so we just launched our 2019 lineup of books. So it's all forthcoming next year, but we've kind of announced what to expect. We have a subscription program where people can kind of buy into the books and ahead of time. And so
wait, is this like crowdfunding a book in a way?
It kind of is, yeah. It really, like, the subscription program goes directly to the book costs. And when, you know, like I said, our books are available nationally, but those margins are always very low, which is mm-hmm. why not a lot of publishers survive. And so our subscribers really bolster our efforts to publish books and allow us to take more risks, publish weird stuff, kind of experimental stuff sometimes, the occasional foray into nonfiction and next year poetry. And then also it translates to more royalties for the authors too, because when you're, it's kind of weird, but like when you're paying cost or even a discount for a book, it's like almost like a donation mm-hmm. because books are so cheap now and available so conveniently through certain behemoths of retail. Our books are available everywhere, and mm-hmm. I don't judge anyone for how they acquire them, but the subscription program is for people who really want to support and kind of go the extra mile. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's perks involved as well that are sort of personalized. So next year we're doing three official books and one partnership. We're doing a partnership with Stetson's literary magazine called Obra Artifact. And so they've run a prose contest, and we're going to take the winner of that contest and help turn it into a sort of book as artifact. Hmm. So that's our to-be-determined sort of mystery object that's going out to subscribers. Then in April, we're publishing Orlando's first poet laureate, Susan Lilly, has her first full collection of poetry called Venus in Retrograde. We've got advanced copies. I just, before I came to the studio, mailed them out to, you know, the trade journals and to the national NPR, if you're listening, mm-hmm. Some certain media and stuff, because you got to get a big head start on national promotion. And that's going to be a great book. She's a lyrical and conversational poet. And she's simply amazing. If you've never heard her read, you'll have lots of opportunities because she's the poet laureate. So, and obviously we'll do a big event for her. Mm-hmm. In the summer, we're publishing a novel called Radio Dark by Shane Hinton. We published his previous short story collection, Pinkies, which is a great example of taking artistic risks. It's a weird, absurdist short story collection about fatherhood. And Radio Dark is a similarly absurd, more bleak, sort of post-apocalyptic take on a plague that befalls Tampa and a disc jockey. It's actually very relevant to radio. A disc jockey and a janitor at the radio station and an FCC employee try to sort of restore humanity via a radio tower to...
Why Tampa?
Yeah. Why Tampa? Well, he's from Tampa. Uh-huh. And also Tampa, I think, is maybe a... I'm not going to say Tampa is a bleak place, but I'm going to say that when you read the book... it fits mood-wise. Mm-hmm. And last but not least, we're publishing in the fall, around October, November, what we're billing kind of tongue-in-cheek as the Great Orlando Novel. It's called Bright Lights, Medium-Sized City by Nathan Hollick. It's most definitely a call-out to Bright Lights, Big City, down to it being written in the second person. The only difference is it's written in five separate chapters that are all written in different kinds of the second person. So the first chapter is a choose-your-own-adventure novel. The second chapter is like a house tour, like going through different houses and real estate, et cetera, et cetera. And speaking of, it sort of is a period piece about Orlando in 2009 at the sort of bottom of the housing crisis when all the prices bottomed out. And it follows a hapless house flipper through his emotional problems, let's just say. Mm-hmm. And along the way, kind of covers a lot of interesting territory, Orlando people, Orlando places. One of the chapters is a big sort of hallucinatory adventure into a bunch of different Orlandoans' brains that are kind of thematically related to this one little guy who wanted to conquer the city. So I'm really excited about that one.
Mm-hmm. How big are the print runs of these books?
We usually do start with 1,000, and that's pretty safe because most of our books usually hit that within a few years. And so, yeah, 1,000. Mm-hmm. We've done a couple extra printings, but not huge ones for certain books. That's kind of to be expected with a press of our size. Mm-hmm. And until one wins an award.
Right, right. And, and where are they made?
So initially, I wanted to print them locally back in 2010. But as it turns out, all the good and affordable and high-quality printers are elsewhere. So we print them in – lately, I've been using exclusively VersaPress, which is an amazing printer out of Illinois. Mm-hmm. Thompson Shore is a great one that we use in Michigan. So I don't know why they're all up there, but that's kind of where – I get the cheapest quote, really, but there's a handful of printers that do a really consistently good job.
Why do you think Orlando doesn't have a book fair similar to what Miami does?
That's a good question. I think a literary community is built out of several pillars, and so small publishers, one of them, or even publishing houses are one pillar. Community events are another pillar. It's important to have conversations like these, in the media. Although we don't have like a dedicated literary show on the radio, and we don't really have a book review section in the paper. So mm-hmm. the media culture and critical culture around books, I think, is another pillar. Orlando lacks that at the moment. And a strong independent bookstore. We have a good one in Winter Park, but, there isn't one in downtown Orlando, and I don't know why that is. But those elements...
There used to be one, right?
There used to be one. I was a part-time employee right before it kind of closed. And mm-hmm. in fact, it was called Urban Think Bookstore. And so the nonprofit entity that Burrow is under is called Urban Think Foundation, kind of named after that bookstore. Because although it had to close its doors, its legacy hopefully continues on a little bit. Mm-hmm. But that was a really rough time for bookstores. Now bookstores are kind of booming, and I'm hoping to see, maybe some eccentric billionaire open something up in downtown, because they're not always... like publishing, they're not cash cows, but I think they're important community fixtures. And so I think those might be a couple of good steps that Orlando could take before we move on to a big festival. Mm-hmm. We occasionally will do something called Litlando, and that's spearheaded by John King of the Drunken Odyssey podcast, a good literary fixture based here in Orlando. And that's a great example of getting writers together and doing panels, and it's more for writers than it is for readers. I think maybe as we grow a little bit more as a community and just grow as a community of readers, I think, and do a better job of reaching out to readers, we'll be ready for a book festival in the next few years, I think.
Ryan Rivas, publisher at Burrow Press, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find archived episodes of Intersection on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. We're in the final week of our fall silent drive. Contributions from listeners like you are the primary way we keep shows like Intersection on the air. So if you appreciate the in-depth interviews and conversations about the issues that you hear on Intersection and the reporting from the 90.7 News team, show your appreciation with a gift of support. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go online and make a contribution at wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.